Welcome to the Sports Ethics Podcast. The Sports Ethics Podcast discusses the many ethical and philosophical issues that arise in and around sport. I am Sean Klein, the sports ethicist. You can read the Sports Ethicist blog at sportsethicist.com, where you can also download podcasts of previous shows, subscribe to the podcast, or find links to related information. The Sports Ethicist is also on Facebook and on Twitter at Sports Ethicist, and you can email the show at sportsethicist@gmail.com. Today is January 22nd, 2015. My guest today is Jack Bowen. Did I say that right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I know. I asked you right before the show how to pronounce it, and of course my mind went blank once I was reading it. So Jack Bowen runs the Sports Law and Ethics blog for the Santa Clara University Institute. So let me read that again. The Sports Law and Ethics blog for the Santa Clara University Institute for Sports Law and Ethics. He's also the author of several books, including, if you can read this, The Philosophy of Bumper Stickers. Welcome to the show, Jack.
Thanks for having me, Sean.
I also wanted to put your Twitter handle out there because I know you tweet a lot about sports ethics issues. So if you don't mind, you want me to plug
That'd
your Twitter?
Great.
All right. So it's at numeral the number one, Jack Bowen, JACKBOWEN. So number one, Jack Bowen. And so we follow each other and often communicate on Twitter. So it's nice to finally engage each other. I guess it's not quite person to person because we're over Skype, but being able to talk at least voice to voice. Now, our topic today covers a range of issues about the boundaries of sportsmanship and how far is too far in the pursuit of victory and issues of things like gamemanship and things like that. And you recently blogged on the Sports Law and Ethics blog about two really interesting sort of cases. One is the question of sportsmanship in icing the kicker. And the other was the use of innovative or non-traditional offensive formations as used by the Patriots in their victory over the Ravens and a little bit over the Colts in the AFC Championship game. And then depending on time, right, there is also this latest controversy swirling around the so-called deflation gate and what's going on with that. All of these sort of touch on these questions of just how far is too far. When we're trying to win and competing in a game, and what role ethical behavior comes in. So I thought we'd first start with icing the kicker. That was the first blog post and the first thing that when we started talking about doing a podcast, we thought we'd talk about that and all these other things keep coming up, which is one of the fun things about being in sports ethics is there's always something to talk about and there's always something new. But with icing the kicker, I was hoping maybe we'd start out with just you summarizing your argument, what it is that you're trying to say in your blog there.
Well, yeah, I think this, like many other issues in sport, I became accustomed to. And my brother, who's a football fan of the Chargers, texted me and he said the Chargers kicker had just been iced. And he said, "This feels wrong. What's your take on icing the kicker?" And I thought, oh, yeah, gosh, I've never thought about it. And it did feel wrong initially. So, spoiler alert, I come up with, my overall conclusion is that it's actually allowable. But in getting to that, I thought back to something I used to do as a coach. And I always like to sort of start out by saying, hey, I'm not the perfect competitor all along either. And I'm kind of working through this on my own as well. But in a penalty shot situation in water polo, right before the shot, I would yell to my goalie, but for the sole benefit of the shooter, he's gripping it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is sort of like asking a golfer right before he makes a big putt, and do you inhale or exhale before you putt, just to get them, to sort of ice them. And I heard from shooters, and these were youth athletes, so that's another possible concern with this act, that it really threw them for a spin because they thought, wait a minute, I am gripping it, but what does that mean, and should I be gripping it less or more? And they would consistently miss the cage.
Okay.
And in reflecting on this, I thought, this is not the proper way to treat one's competitor, to sort of ice them. And so that's what got me into thinking that this is a really interesting sportsmanship issue in the sense that you're doing the same thing in football. But when it comes down to it, the difference between my example, which I still argue is not sportsmanlike, and thus I'd refrain from doing that, and the icing the kicker example, is that coaches have three opportunities in a game to stop the game whenever they want. And that's what makes that different. And they can use those however they see fit, except they can't, according to the rules, call a timeout twice consecutively.
Right.
That is literally considered unsportsmanlike. But to call a timeout whenever you feel you'd like to use that timeout is totally within the rules. And it's not that everything within the rules is morally allowable, but in this case, I think it is.
Yeah, so there's a lot of interesting things that you're bringing,
yeah, sorry,
bringing up there. No, that's great. And I was just taking a note on one of them, and so I know I'm trying to figure out where I want to start. Oh, right. Yeah, the last point that you're making about just because it's in the rules and it's allowable by the rules doesn't necessarily mean it's the right thing to do, right? Does that kind of capture what you're
right,
saying?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important distinction and to focus on, that some things might be allowable, not allowable, but then that doesn't really map onto directly, at least, what might be moral or not moral, or what might be, to put it in more sort of virtue ethics terms, sort of honorable or dishonorable. Because it's, I find it sometimes useful to think about it this way, because, you know, when you start talking about, well, is it right or wrong, is it moral or immoral, I think some people, you know, they immediately kind of shut down or start to think just in terms of action constraints. What is it that you can and can't do? Rather than thinking more broadly about how is it that I really want to be? What kind of person, what kind of athlete, what kind of individual do I want to be? Is this the kind of person I want to be? Is this what I want to tell my child to be like? Or you're a coach, and so you're athletes. This is the way you coach it up. And so that's why sometimes I think, okay, well, maybe this is allowable and you know, not immoral, but is it really honorable? Is this allow you to achieve sort of an honorable victory? And so that, I think that those honorable versus dishonorable and allowable versus not allowable, those, we often might think that those overlap, but I think that they sometimes don't. Is that kind of capture a little bit about how you were approaching the issue of icing the kicker, sort of saying, well, it's allowable, but it's a little, may not be the most honorable way to go about things.
Well, excuse me. I mean, I guess this is where this particular situation is so interesting, because it seems to fall a little bit in the gray area of that whole issue. I mean, to spill a little bit into the other sort of kicker icing example is, you know, in football, which happened recently when coaches were allowed to call timeouts, where the coach could call a timeout, you know, a second before, immediately prior to the snap.
Yeah, and you so see the coach down on the sideline just standing there right next to the ref and calling it with like 1 second left.
Linesman, timeout, but yeah. the kicker, they run the play, they hike it, he kicks the ball. So that one, to me, does seem a little less honorable, because now it's almost as though the coach has inserted himself as a player. But again, I don't want to divert too much from the exact question you're asking. I still think that if you want to use one of your timeouts to call a timeout before the other team kicks the ball, and it's within the rules, and you're not doing it immediately prior to the snap where they have to run the play twice. Mm-hmm. I feel like until the league comes in and makes a rule change, that is considered, it's an honorable way to play the game, because you're playing within the context of the rules, and you're just choosing to use your timeouts in a strategic way, but you're giving something up. I mean, maybe you saved a timeout that you could have used earlier on to give your team a rest, to run a new play, et cetera.
Right.
So you've given something up, and you're hoping to gain something else within the institute of this sport that's governed by the rules.
Yeah, I think the focus on the cost benefit there of you're paying a price here, you're giving up an opportunity for a timeout, which might cost you the game if you need that timeout at the end to set up for your own field goal, or it means that you can't now, you don't have the timeout, so you can't challenge a play that needs to be challenged, and other kinds of situations. And so you have to take that into account. Is it really worth the risk? A cost to it, like you said. So I think that's important to focus on. And I mean, I hadn't really thought about it until your blog post as well. And so I've been thinking about it a lot since then. But I've never been a real big fan of it.
Right.
In some ways, just because it doesn't really usually seem to work. It does on occasion, particularly when It's a far kick,
Right.
And they don't, and they get the kick off, and then they have to re-kick it. That sometimes seems to have an effect, although I don't know what the stats on that. I think overall the statistics show that it really doesn't have much of an effect. I mean, that's not necessarily a case for it or against it. Well, I guess it's a little bit of a case against it, but it my feeling, it always seemed to make the game a little bit less interesting. It always seemed a little bit kind of, what's the word? I don't know, maybe chintzy a little bit, that it's like, really, this isn't, it probably isn't going to affect the kicker. Most of the kickers at this point are expecting it, or they just block it out and they don't care. And so it's not really going to have an effect on them. And so it just kind of makes the game a little bit longer, and isn't that much more, it doesn't make it any more interesting. It's not like the kick is that much more interesting. Kicks aren't usually very interesting to begin with, but, you know, so it doesn't make the game any more interesting. And so I've never been a big fan of it, but thinking about, well, is it unsportsmanlike? And I think I kind of follow along with where you're going. Well, not really. I mean, there does seem to be an element of it that's, like I said, kind of chintzy, but
right.
not really, you know, a wrong thing to do, because it is a completely contrived situation within the game, and the game allows it,
right?
And that it's part of the strategy, and it's a strategy that comes with a cost, and so people have to evaluate it,
right?
But I did like your point about, and I think this is some, you know, a thread to pull on, is the coach inserting himself into the play. And I think that's the one thing when I was reading your blog post that kind of jumped out at me as, the thing that really made me, I have to rethink about way I think, because at first I was like, oh, no, there's nothing wrong with it. But that one little, other than that, I don't really like it. But right. So in some ways it's more of an aesthetic argument, but in terms
right.
of like, okay, well, should this really be something that we focus on and change the rules to avoid? And the idea of the coach getting involved, almost inserting himself as a player, I thought was interesting. And did you want to amplify that at all? Or
yeah, I appreciate it. I mean, you know, you've been up a lot there, and you're right that the sort of the saber metrics of it all show that it's really not. I mean, these guys are professionals. Kickers, especially, are of such sound mind that it really only is slightly effective when it's a kick that's longer than 45 yards. But again, you follow up, you know, looking at the ethics of a situation, it's the intent that we're interested in. And, you know, the rulemakers actually said once this started happening, and the icing, the last second icing was actually working. There were a couple of examples, you know, in 2006, they called a timeout and the Raiders made the field goal to win it. But then, oh no, you have to take it again. The coach whispered timeout over there on this, you know, essentially sort of like blocking the kick. Oh, we have to kick it again. Oh, you missed it. You actually lost. And the rulemakers, you know, those in charge of the NFL Rules Commission, you know, literally said, it just doesn't seem right. This seems like a sportsmanship issue. And that's really easy to change if that's what you think. You just simply change the rules, and it would be very easy to make a rule against this. And so I think one of the interesting things about sport in and of itself is this sort of it's this codified institution of rules which define the game. And you look at, you know, when rules are broken or tweaked or things are done outside of the box, you can either change the rule. Like I think of like the Fosbury flop, you know, that Fosbury is the first guy to go over the bar over his back. Everyone else is jumping over it, you know, chest first, which seemed to make sense. Like, why would you go over backwards? They could have changed the rules and said, oh, that's ingenious, but that's not what we meant. But instead they said, no, just get your body over the bar. Whereas if you look at something else, like one of my favorites, just because the visual of it, that's known as the Hoke sacrifice back in the 50s when they hit a ground ball and there's a runner on first and second, and the runner on second caught the ball. So he was out, but at the time there wasn't a rule for any subsequent outs.
Yeah.
So he essentially prevented a double play by fielding the ball as a runner. And so, you know, the next week a rule appears in the rule book. If you're a runner and you interfere with the ball, you're out, and whoever else we think should have been out is out. They changed the rules because that's not sportsmanlike. That's not how the game should be played. So it gets into this sort of, you know, the notion of this human institution, and if something's unsportsmanlike, there's a really easy way to tweak that behavior.
Right, and I mean, that's one of the, you're hitting on one of the things that I love about studying sport and thinking about sport is yeah, I mean, it's this human institution. We create the rules, but at the same time, the rules are in evolution, and constantly being pushed on and tested and interpreted in different ways, and that kind of boils up through the institution, and then they can decide whether to try to embrace that. Or to get rid of it, or try to get rid of it at least. And so I think it does become a microcosm of trying to study how societies, how institutions actually evolve. And I'm more of the sort of Hayekian or Scottish Enlightenment view of civilization and culture as the product of human action, but not human design, spontaneous order, emergent orders. And I think sport is like that. It emerges from the interaction of the participants. There is this overarching set of rules, but usually those rules get challenged, adjusted, interpreted, and then have to be rewritten or adjusted because of the way the participants play the game. And so they may not be trying to go out there and create a new rule, as in the cases you were talking about, just trying to do something, get an edge, do something different, pursue their game as they think might be best. And it can have this effect through their actions and through other individuals, other participants in the sport taking similar actions or building off of those actions. So it makes it really interesting to look back and see how these sports have evolved and changed over time. Even baseball, which we often think about as being the same, right? What's the quote from Field of Dreams? Everything else has changed, but except baseball, Ray, except baseball, which is utter bullshit, right? I mean, baseball has changed a lot since the 80s even, and to go back into the 50s and the 60s and then into the 20s. And baseball has it's not unrecognizable, but it's a very different game in a lot of ways. If you look back every 20 years, I think that it does look quite different. Maybe it doesn't change as much as football, which, seems to change every year sometimes in terms of what counts as a catch and not a catch, and what's pass interference and what's not. I mean, sometimes I don't even know, and I've been watching football for a long time, and it's like I don't know anymore what counts. But that's a separate conversation. So one aspect of the example that you use, both in terms of icing the kicker, but also I think the water polo example of you're gripping the ball, right? That's from water polo, right? So
Right,
he's, yeah.
yes.
And and so you've decided that that's inappropriate or unsportsmanlike, and so maybe come back, say a little bit more about why that qualifies as. I think somewhere in one of your, you said the burden lies with the individual who's going to. Let me get the exact quote here because I liked it. Let's see, which one was it in? As usual, the burden of proof lies with those who looking to condemn the action. That was in the icing the kicker. And so I like that line, and I think that that's in most circumstances, I think that's probably true. And so I want to push back a little bit and ask for you to show me how you're meeting that burden in the case of the water polo example of saying you're gripping the ball. What is it that makes that unsportsmanlike?
Well, there's one distinction which I've been willing to make recently, and this may seem somewhat tangential, is the youth sport experience where I'm a coach, I'm an educator, I'm, a so-called expert in this field. And as I'm standing on the pool deck, I'm dealing with a minor, I'm dealing with someone whose brain isn't fully formed, I'm dealing with a power struggle, even though I'm not that player's coach. That player, is a child and, has to treat me with such as, such and such respect. So I do think because of that power difference, like I might, one in that situation, might be beholden to a slightly higher standard than if it were adults playing. And I think that makes the decision in this particular case even easier for me, that I shouldn't take advantage of all of those situations in the sporting context.
So let me jump in just
Sure.
on, because I think you're right. I don't think that that's sort of a pedantic or tangential distinction at all. The between youth and I guess adult sports or adults engaging in sport, because the situation is quite different, I think, when dealing with youth sports. And so And so I don't know if I'd say a higher standard, but I think the standard is different because in some ways the goals are different when you're doing, because you spoke as an educator. So in a way, what you're doing there, the goods of that activity are still, they're similar to adult or professional or a more elite level sport because you're trying to win, it's engaging in competition, all those things that are goods of sport. But there's that added element of the educational value. And the educational mission, I guess we could say, of that activity. Either you're teaching them the game or it's within the context of a broader educational institute, institution. And so it has that added element. And I think that does shift the standard. So I don't know if it's a hierarchical shift that it's somehow higher or if it's just, well, it's a different context. And so we're applying these sort of ideas and principles in somewhat of a different way because we had this added element of the educational role of things. So I think that is important because that...
Yeah.
That does draw out because I don't think we can talk about sport, athletics at every level in the same way.
Right.
Because there are different aims, different goods involved here, and we have to acknowledge that, and that those are going to affect how and which principles and standards are going to be applied and how they're going to be applied.
Right. Well, then we're in agreement on that, and I think let's cool. Well, it's nice to say that, isn't it? But if we take this to an adult league or, the Olympics, the he's gripping it example with the intent implied there seems to be closer to the spectrum of taunting. Like it doesn't seem like an honorable way to treat someone with whom one is, striving together. If we break the roots down of competition, that doesn't seem like an honorable way to treat one's opponent. And like I said, if you agree that it seems closer to the taunting end of the spectrum, you can't, play the game honorably while simultaneously taunting someone. So I guess that's where if we jump out of the youth sport arena and just get to regular old sport, I still would sort of place that sort of judgment on it.
Okay, good. Yeah. I think we're really getting at something here. Cause, I agree with you. Certainly, yeah, if you're taunting and engaging in that sort of level of things or showing of disrespect to your opponent, then you can't simultaneously be respecting them, at least not in the same way. And that does seem to undermine the striving together, the mutual quest for excellence, however you want to define sport, competition, right. Sportsmanship. But there is the boundary line there is still... It's still really fuzzy for me. Maybe it always will be because I do see, certain elements of trash talking and other sort of quote mental aspects of the game where you might be, like what you're doing in trash talking, maybe a little bit of, maybe we'll keep taunting out because that sort of carries with it. I don't want to bait the question with it, but so let's stay with something like trash talking where, two wide receivers wide receiver and defensive back are jawing at each other before the play at the line of scrimmage, trying to get in each other's heads a little bit, trying to make them think that, okay, well, I'm focusing on you. And so that person kind of focuses back on the wide receivers focusing on what the defensive back is saying instead of the audible that gets called by the quarterback or that they missed the hike and their timing's off a little bit, whatever the case may be. And that to me seems acceptable. I don't have a problem with that kind of jarring about like soccer matches, particularly the European ones where they have all these chants about individual players and they'll chant things, when the players, a visiting player comes in, they'll chant all kinds of things, making fun of Wayne Rooney or something like that.
Right.
And that seems fine to me. It seems playful. It seems fun. It seems to add to from a fan's perspective, adds to the overall enjoyment of the game. And going back to the sort of trash talking, that seems to be just part of the test of, I think the way Leslie Howe, who wrote an article called Gamemanship, kind of one of those standard go-to articles in the sports ethics literature, she talks about it as the test of psychological strength and preparedness. That as a wide receiver, particularly as we're talking about with the icing the kicker, as a professional, part of your preparedness, part of your psychological profile or preparedness for the game is not to allow that stuff to affect you, whether it's coming from the fans, whether it's coming from your opposing team, or whether it's coming from that internal voice in your head that says, you can't do this. This is crazy.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's what I think. When I see these kickers get up for game winning kicks, it's just, I don't want to be that guy. And I realize that's why I'm not a professional athlete, is because I don't want the ball in that situation because I'm too afraid.
Right.
But what makes the difference between, I don't have the skills either, but if I had the skills, but still that psychological profile, I wouldn't be able to be a professional athlete. What separates me from someone like Adam Vinatieri or, Mason Crosby, some of these great kickers, is they can get in that situation, game on the line, they win. They go to the Super Bowl, they lose, they go home. I couldn't take that, but they can. And that kind of mental preparedness and mental strength, psychological strength, seems to be an important test of the athletic competition, any competition.
Right.
But I think also athletic competition. And, I think it ties into, as an athletic competition, where it's not just an intellectual skill, not merely a physical skill. It's your whole being, your mental and physical, and the way they're interacting, you're nervous, your heart's pumping, your blood pressure's up, you're all kinds of hormones probably pumping through your system, but you're still able to sort of control those and focus and get the job done, that's part of the test of the athlete. And so whether it's trash talking or whether it's the crowd, that seems okay until you cross certain lines. So obviously,
right.
If you start using racial epithets or things like that, I think you've crossed the line. But it's not so much a line about sportsmanship or trash talking. It's a line about more generic ethical behavior and what's appropriate for civilized individuals. So the issue then of you saying what you're saying, you're gripping the ball, comes close to that. So then there's a question of, does it go over the line or not? And where might that line be and why? Why would we think that line is sort of there?
Right. Well, yeah, this is a really, it'd be great if you could convince me that I'm not as unethical of a coach as I am. And one of the things I really like that you touched on is, like, are we asking an aesthetic question or are we asking a moral question? I mean, I was a goalie, and my style of play was very much, when you make that huge save, I would actually kind of go underwater for a moment and come up stone-faced as though it was like, big deal. Mm-hmm. That's what I do. Like, that's not even a big deal to me. I thought it was also kind of the honorable way to behave, but there's no doubt that part of what I was aiming to do there was to, get a quick look at that shooter in the eye and let him know that I'm in charge of the situation. He's not going to score his next shot. Yeah. Next
but
one.
It's kind of intimidating. You're sort of like, wow, that was a tough shot. And he just kind of saved that like it was nothing. Wow.
And again, because just listening to you talk through this, I always thought that the other approach, goalies in every sport, after they make a save, they just go crazy and they're pumping their fists and they're, as though they're intimidating and thinking like, well, that the right thing to do is that, and on the one hand, it's just an aesthetic question. On the other hand, it's a style of play,
mm-hmm.
but it's intimidating, but in a different way. And so, I think that actually listening to you talk through it may actually be more of an aesthetic question than a question of sport ethics. So in this sense, I've actually been pushed, which is what I really love. I mean, just about listening to your blogs in general, as I've been sitting here thinking for 25 years about this, and here I am tweaking my view. So thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
But so we look at this question, what, the he's gripping it, or the chanting, or the trash talking, the I'm going to take you deep, a receiver saying that versus saying like, I think your girlfriend's ugly.
Right.
Where you say, whoa, like on the one hand, that first example is a sporting example. We're here playing a sport and you're saying you're going to take me deep. The other example is like, you don't treat people. You don't say that to someone on the street. You don't say that to a classmate. And you certainly don't say that to someone in the sports field.
Right.
So then what I wonder, you brought up the crowd and how we treat athletes who are participating. And I've written a little bit on this, the airball phenomenon. And I always, when I frame it to people, in the way that it actually happens, they always say, well, I never thought about it that way. So you've got these guys who are trying desperately to bounce this ball and get it into this circle that we've elevated 10 feet off the ground. And when they fail, when they go out and fail at the task of hitting the circle, the entire group that's there to enjoy this mocks them and celebrates that person's failure. And it's like, God, that seems kind of like an odd phenomenon. Is that how we want to treat people? Well, that's how it's done. Well, yeah, I know that's how it is done. I'm just wondering, like, do I want to gather all these people, you know, of all ages, and mock that person for failing? Huh. I'm not so sure that's how we should be treating people. And then to your comment, but it's the sporting context. And so there's some gray area there.
Yeah, I definitely think there's a gray area. And I think that it's an interesting way to frame it that way. Like, do I want to mock those people versus the way some people might frame it as, well, it's part of the fun of the game. It's part of the fun of the competition. You know, my friends and I, we were just talking the other day in different contexts, but sort of like, you know, as he didn't grow up in the States, he grew up in Europe, and he says, you know, but he, you know, it seems like teenage boys, he says, is this normal? Like teenage boys in America, they seem to put each other down all the time. Like, and the closer they are as friends, the more they mock and tease and jab at each other. And he says, it's like, when I grew up, we didn't do that. We lifted each other up. And so my friend and I, who are both grew up in the States, we said, yeah, you know, that in a way it was a kind of indirect show of respect, and care of your male friends by being mean to them. It's a weird way to think about it.
Right.
But it's sort of like, well, if you didn't care about them, you wouldn't even pay attention to them. But because you care about them, there was this sort of thing that you had to sort of jab at them and tease them. And my boyhood friends that I'm still friends with, we still talk all the time. We still say mean things to each other that if I said to somebody else or someone else who didn't know us heard would be like, wow, that was really mean. But between us, it's almost a sign of love, right? Which is, and I'm not trying to say that the airball thing is a sign of love, but there is a sort of a sense in which you might put it in that context of, well, this is part of the fun of the game, that when you, and part of the challenge, if you go out and you fail, you're going to be subject to some teasing, to some mocking.
Right.
But when you succeed, we'll also, you know, we'll acknowledge that and cheer that. Or, you know, when you go, that's part of the home field advantage. You know, when you go to another court or you go to another field, that's your opponent, you know, you're going to face this, but back at home, it's the opposite.
Right.
And so it kind of balances out. And then you have the psychological test of just shutting out that noise versus not being able to, and the fans having an effect versus not having an effect. And so it does seem to be all part of the context to a degree. I think there are certainly, you know, boundaries to that, and going too far in that, and certainly fan bases do that, and we have, well, there's all kinds of bad stories, things that were chanted that certainly shouldn't have been, or throwing things onto the court or into the field,
right,
and stuff like that. Obviously, I mean, there part of the line that might be drawn here is to the extent that you're interfering, inserting yourself into the game. And so, you know, when the fans are cheering and chanting, right, there's a sense in which they're kind of interfering with the game or inserting themselves in. But in a way, that's a time-honored, in most sports at least, a time-honored part of the game, right, that the fans are there. That's why, in a way, you play in front. It's a spectacle. So you do play in front of fans, and that their cheering does have an effect on the game. But if you go too far and you actually get involved in the game and you go onto the court, or you throw things on the court, or you do things that interfere with the officiating and so on, that those all seem to go certainly too far.
Right.
And then so that's what drove me to you know, what that aspect of your blog post about the coach and the coach inserting himself in, and that there's a role for the coach, but that role has limits, and that the coach isn't a player. Unless they're a player coach, but we don't have too many of those anymore.
Right.
And, you know, but even then there's the player and then there's the coach. So even though they might occupy those roles, there's certain things that they're supposed to do as the player, certain things that they're supposed to do as a coach. And this also relates to something we were talking right before the podcast started, about the officials. And maybe we'll get to this if we talk about Deflategate, or we can jump into it now too. Sort of, you know, what is the role of the player versus the official versus the coach, and what they all seem to have distinct roles that is divided up, and this is division of labor. The players play, the referees officiate, and the coaches, you know, they coach. They shouldn't be playing, they shouldn't be officiating, the officials shouldn't be involved in the strategy of the game or with the players and so on. The players shouldn't be calling fouls and so on. And that's there's a nice level of division of labor there to try to keep things objective and to keep the tests of the athletic competition what we want them to be. And so when the coach engages the game as a player, then that and maybe that's in the water polo example, maybe that's what's wrong about that is that you're putting yourself into the match in a way that's different than when you're just shouting instructions to your goalies, which is appropriate as a coach, but then you're actually trying to interfere with the play rather than giving strategic advice and whatnot, that maybe that's you're taking on, you're going beyond the bounds of being a coach and into being a player. Maybe that's what's inappropriate about that. So yeah. I don't know, maybe I pulled you back now to your original position.
No, I do think that's a really nice connection and a through line. And I'm also wondering, I mean, I know we're headed towards looking at trick plays and, and I'm wondering if there's this sense of, and this has already come up a couple of times today, but, you know, the sporting versus the non-sporting and like the getting at the crux of our humanity. And, you know, you can say this to your player, but you can't talk about his girlfriend, you know. And so looking at, you know, some of the trick plays that have come up recently, like the faking a heart attack trick play, which was run in a bowl game, you know, and you think, okay, like this really isn't a sporting move. Like, if this guy is having a heart attack, then we as like human beings need to stop what we're doing, whether I'm at work or I'm playing football or I'm writing a paper, and go over and attend to the person who's dying.
Right.
And so to have that built into the sporting context then either forces us to say, well, now I'm playing football, so I'm going to ignore when human beings are experiencing profound suffering.
Right. Yeah, we don't want that.
Right. Or every time someone experiences suffering, I'm going to go attend to them. Ha ha, I tricked you. So it seems like maybe there's that nice through line with a number of the instances that have come up, whether it was, you know, what I was yelling as a coach, where we draw the line in trash talking, and where we can start to draw the line in trick plays and deception. Like at the least on one side of the spectrum, we can't involve the sort of normal human instances where we must reach out to, you know, fellow humankind and attend to them. So like, if we're starting to draw a line looking at trick plays, at least we can stop. We can start at fake heart attack, the fake injury. And as I actually mentioned in my recent blog, I think this is one of a number of reasons why we could look at I don't know if it's fair to call it a play, but the quote unquote fake play of soccer's flopping. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a guy writhing around in anguish. And again, watching slow motion, he wasn't even touched, but yeah. Are we supposed to walk by indifferent to him? Because sometimes, you know, the boy cried wolf, or should we attend to him and call a foul? So I think that's at least a good starting point.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think that's I like that, you know, this, that's something to pull on, because, you know, one way I've always been to Randolph Feazell's discussion of sportsmanship, and he talks about this sort of balance of non-seriousness and seriousness, bringing in the sort of play concepts of, or the concept of play, and how there's this non-seriousness or this serious non-seriousness, which is kind of a mouthful, but you're in this play world, you're engaging in this sort of extraordinary world, and certain things pull you out of that. And the real world seriousness, true seriousness comes to bear. And destroys the play moment, destroys the play world.
Yeah.
You know, and so a real injury, someone, you know, breaking their leg or getting knocked out or whatever, right? That destroys the play world for that moment, because the real world creeps in, and now you're no longer in the play world.
Yeah.
And so I think that those kinds of plays that trade off of bringing in this real world seriousness in order to take you out of the play world so that they can get a strategic advantage, that I think that's unsportsmanlike, and that's wrong, right? Because you're undermining the very point of you're undermining the very sort of metaphysical nature of the game. And so that I think is definitely something to draw a line around. So, no, these things really shouldn't be done. They're because they really are undermining things. And I like the way, you know, the sort of, they get at the core of our humanity, require us to step outside of the sporting context to attend to our competitor. So it's pulling us out of the sport, it's pulling us out of the play. And so that's inappropriate. Whereas, you know, in terms of, I think you Did you dub it formation gate in your blog, or did you come across that term
I'm
somewhere else?
I did dub it that. It's wordy, and I couldn't resist. And now that we've got deflation gate, I guess I don't feel so bad about the word. Formation gate is.
I do hope as a society we can come up with some other sort of signal of controversy other than, playing off of this.
I'm guilty of complicity here.
By now, 35, 40-year-old Watergate sort of thing. But, right, so the formation issue was that the Patriots were engaging in a kind of trick play. I don't know if I'd even qualify it as a trick play, but doing something that was non-traditional in their formations that caught the Ravens completely off guard for several plays and really frustrated them. And actually led to, as you note in your blog, an unsportsmanlike conduct call, penalty against, the Ravens, which I didn't really know what was going on. I watch most games on mute because I don't like the announcers. And I was trying to figure out why was Harbaugh on the field? Because I didn't notice what was going on either. I was wondering why Humanui was catching balls all of a sudden. But it was strange to see Harbaugh throwing a fit like that until later when it was revealed. So, but anyway, so it doesn't strike me now. Full disclosure. Most listeners know I am a Patriots fan, so I do try to strive for objectivity. But full disclosure on this. But that kind of gamesmanship, right? Maybe gamesmanship might be better than trickery, right? Because it's, one of the things you're doing in the blog, right? Is in a way to. All right. Well, then what are you trying to do in your blog about deception and trickery? I'll let you try to say it rather than me.
I think it is, as you alluded to, and as I say in my piece, which I got near the end in a discussion with a friend of mine, actually an ex-player of mine. I'm not even sure we're using the right language. It's a tricky play,
mm-hmm.
But to actually label it a trick play seems like wordsmithing to me. I mean, talking to a few people who are much more steeped in football than I am, our coach, a friend of mine who played football and really gets it, considered as a real thinking man's game. So, part of the skill and strategy of football is coming up with nuanced formations.
Yeah.
That's literally an offensive strategy. And there are a couple others, but coming up. And when our coach saw this, he said, wow, great formation. He didn't even think trick play. So, as Harbaugh said, it was clear, quote, it was clearly deception. Well, so is a lot of football and pretty much every formation. And you can go through, everything. The quarterback hands it off and then kind of hides the ball down by his leg, and the running back runs, and then the quarterback goes off to the side, or the double pass play that they ran.
And defensively, right, where you fake a blitz. You fake like you're coming up to blitz, but it's really the other guy who's standing behind you, and you will go back into coverage, and then that guy runs in. So confuses the running back or something about who he's supposed to cover.
Look at Oregon's 2-point conversions. I mean, the first time I saw that, I thought, oops, I don't know if these guys know how to do this. I wonder why they're all standing off to the side. That's not very smart. And then you realize what they're doing within the confines of the rules and say, oh my gosh, that's genius. How has no one ever thought to do this before? Within the confines of the rules to go set up like that and see if the defense comes up with a formation that is ill-suited to them and then run the 2-point conversion play. So, that got me to thinking about trick plays in general and trying to decipher just what is it. We've already established the one side of the spectrum, the faking the heart attack. We've got the other side of the spectrum, like a fake handoff. I guess you could call that a quote unquote trick play. So now again, we're trying to find this gray area where, making sure that it's within the tests of the game and that it's, following the rules. And so I did give a few, an example of something that I don't feel is a sportsmanlike trick play is the barking dog play in basketball.
Oh, yeah.
You YouTube this, you can see this, the kid gets down.
I'd never heard of that. I was like, what is he talking about? Barking guy gets on his hands and feet. That's crazy.
Yeah. And barks and an interesting one has come up. The sideline hangout play. I'm starting to rethink. But, you know, where the one of the players acts like they stand right next to the sideline next to a group of their own.
Didn't Cleveland try to do that with Manziel this year?
And exactly.
They got called on a penalty, though, because I guess that's illegal. The way he did it,
like he was out of formation and wasn't prepared or something. But, you know, tricking the other team into thinking you're standing out of bounds when you're actually in bounds isn't really – that's not really a skill being tested in football.
Right.
But the obvious retort is, like, says who? Like, wait a minute. Why, if the other team can't count, you know, figure out where the 11 players are in this clearly defined area, then they're not as observant and disciplined as they need to be, and they should pay for it with silly play.
Yeah, and well, I think when we talk about these kinds of gamesmanship or these sort of pushing up against the rules or using the rules in innovative ways, one way that I think about it, at least in terms of what might be acceptable versus not, is and the reason why I think like the form now, partly because I'm a Patriots fan, but I also think the sort of innovative formations that were used in this situation are things that are in some ways laudable, right? I mean, they're not sort of like little one trick ponies. They're not sort of sleight of hand. It's more, you know, about pushing the game forward a little bit, And the reason why I think it's praiseworthy is because it's actually puts a greater – and this gets at kind of what you were talking about. It's putting a greater test on both the defense and the offense in terms of accounting for all the players, knowing who they're supposed to cover, who's on the line, who's not on the line, who's eligible, who isn't eligible, and having – so the defense has to absorb more information and process it and react to it. But the offense has to be careful too.
Right.
Patriots in the Colts game, they – kind of screwed it up at one point. One guy was supposed to be ineligible, but he didn't report as eligible or vice versa or something like that. And so he, you know, they were called for a penalty. It ended up not mattering. They got a touchdown, but it requires the offense then to be more nuanced and more careful in how they set things up. And so it pushes the game forward because it tests both sides and tests them in a football way, right? So that, you know, where you're doing kind of the sleight of hand or like, oh, maybe they won't see me type of play, that seems like, okay, once you might get that by someone once or twice, but eventually, you know, it's just not going to work and it kind of looks silly. You know, but even sometimes these new formations might not really stick. So, I mean, we think about the Wildcat. So the Wildcat came in and blew the doors off of everybody for like, you know, half the season. And people are like, this is the way of the future. Everyone's going to be doing it. And you still see it now and then. But and at first, because the defenses just couldn't figure out how to deal with it. And it took them a while. They eventually did. And now you don't really see it that much every once in a while, which is probably better. I don't want to see it every time. Every once in a while, that's fine. But it keeps the defenses on their toes. They have to, for teams that do that sometimes or have players that are capable of doing that, it's an added element that the defense has to keep track of. And it's an added element that the offense has to figure out, when are we going to do this? When are we not going to do this? You know, how are we going to portray this? So that kind of pushing against the rules, I think, is laudable because it makes the game more interesting and better and makes the players better and makes them push for new levels of excellence. But some of the other examples, the barking like a dog, the sideline hangout. I was also thinking of A-Rod when he was he was running around first or third and he yelled out or something like
that.
I mean, that just seems kind of, how do my students put it? They call it Bush League, right? you know, it's not really testing anybody's ability. You're just trying to catch them off guard sort of versus sort of kind of pushing – you know, like pushing on the rules to understand them better, or pushing on the individual and their preparedness for the game. How psychologically prepared are they? Whereas just some shout right in some guy's ear, you know, that doesn't seem to really test anything. That's my thought.
Rod's example. And looking at these other plays, in that example, he doesn't give anything up, right? He's still getting to the base, and maybe the guy catches it, maybe he doesn't. But in these other plays, like in formation gate, if it's defended correctly, if the defense realizes who's an eligible receiver and who isn't, they've just lost their eligible the actual receivers, right? And when you watch the play again, the receiver who's feigning to be a receiver can't go downfield.
Right.
He has to run this little bogus backwards slant, he's taken out of the play. It's essentially like an 11 on 10 in favor of the defense.
Right.
So the offense has given something up. They're taking a risk. If the defense figures out what we're doing, it's 11 on 10, and then we are in big trouble. We're going to lose yards here. That's, you know, when you look, the other play, it's interesting. The play that I referenced in that blog as sort of a, here's a play that's in the gray area, but is totally acceptable. And then the formation gate is acceptable. And it was the bounce Ruski. And I've gotten a lot of pushback about that, saying, wait a minute, you assumed this was okay, but it's not. And I started to think it wasn't. The play is where the foot, you know, the quarterback throws it slightly behind himself. So, and then actually bounces the ball on the ground. So it's technically a lateral and therefore a fumble, but the receiver catches the ball, and then the entire offense just stands there as though it was actually an incomplete pass.
So they kind of faint.
And now the receiver is wide open because everyone said, oh, that was a bad pass. The receiver's wide open, so they throw it to the receiver, touchdown. And, you know, again, the friends of mine involved in football, it's an inherent part of being well-coached. And when you watch football, you see this. You play until the whistle blows.
Yep.
That's the only thing that stops play. And so when a guy is being backed up for negative yardage, you don't just stop tackling him. The referees come in, you know, okay, you got to stop pushing it backwards. And they're also giving something up, right? They're bouncing an oblong ball on the ground and assuming it's going to be caught, and they're on their heels. And so again,
very risky.
Good gray area example where you're really using a strong knowledge of the game and understanding how the game is played. It's within the rules, and it's a clever, ingenious play that also gives something up. Like you're at a huge risk here for a loss of yardage.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Or even someone else coming in and picking up, getting the ball before the quarterback or the other guy's able to pick it up and running it back for a touchdown. So I mean, it could really be a very dangerous play. Yeah, good. Okay, well, because it's so much in the news right now and on a lot of people's minds, this deflation gate thing, and it seems somewhat, it's a little bit different than what we're talking about, because most of kind of what we're talking about are things that are, I guess I should say, sort of technically, you know, legal, right? Or they fit within the rules. Maybe they fit the rules, but not quite the spirit of the rules, or something like that. They're within the rules, but they're in this gray area, and we're not really quite sure whether they're appropriate, even if they're within the rules or not. Whereas Deflation Gate, we're another gate here, right? And we're dealing with a situation where, if there is alteration or tampering with the football, that is a clear violation of the rule. And so that's what the Patriots are alleged to have done. What we know now is that, or what's at least been reported, is that the 11 of the 12 tested footballs at halftime were underinflated. There's some reports that it might have been as much as 2 pounds per square inch. And so it's somewhere between 12.5 and 3.5 pounds per square inch, I think, is what it's been reported. I mean, this is just what's been reported. So I don't need to go into too much detail. But we don't have any definitive statement from the NFL at this point, which is a criticism that I have anyway, is that the investigation doesn't really seem to be very transparent or direct. But that's kind of the NFL for you. So anyway, we have the situation where the balls were underinflated. We don't necessarily know why yet or how it happened, but the allegation is that the Patriots in some way, or someone within the Patriots organization, did this intentionally for an advantage. So, and so it's getting a lot of media buzz. And so, so it seems within this realm of, you know, how far is too far in trying to win? And so is actually breaking a rule like this, which doesn't seem to be a major constitutive rule, but it's a rule. Is it, you know, is it wrong? Right. You know, how should it be punished? I thought I'd include it in mostly because of the news cycle. But so what are some of your thoughts on this?
As we said offline, and I sort of joked and I said, what's even interesting about this, at least from a from a philosophical standpoint. It's certainly interesting, you know, psychologically, sociologically, why, how. But as then we got to talking, looking at like notions of responsibility, which is clearly like a moral issue, and is Tom Brady responsible for coming out and saying, hey, you know, I've been gripping thousands of footballs a day for the last 20 years, and these footballs are noticeably deflated. Like, I have to imagine that he could notice the difference. But is it Tom Brady's responsibility to say, like, oh, let me see if the lines were done properly, and oh, looks like this field is an inch too narrow, or right. Let me see if the balls were inflated. Let me get the PSI. Like, that's supposed to be something that the official, the guy running the game, is coming and saying, here's the official ball. And he says, okay, thank you, set, hike. I guess it sounds like I'm answering the question rhetorically. The answer might be absolutely. He knows what an official ball should feel like. This doesn't feel like an official ball. He should let someone know, because it's clearly to his advantage. It's easier to throw. It's easier to catch. It's easier to run with. He should let everyone know that we're not actually playing with an official ball here.
All right. Yeah, and it's tricky. I mean, it goes back to what we were talking about a little bit earlier about, okay, players play, coaches coach, refs. And so Tom Brady's a player. He's not supposed to be officiating the game.
Right.
But, you know, at the same time, there are instances where it would seem like, you know, players do report, you know, certain violations of the rules, not only ones that are on the other team, but although that's usually the situation, so they have a bias there. But you know, one context here, though, and this is, you know, when I talk about with my students, sometimes they say, "Oh, you know, players play, refs ref, and the player shouldn't play a role in there." And that's probably too strong for my taste.
Yeah.
You know, I think about that commercial where they're playing basketball and the kid tells the coach, you know, it was out on me, coach. You know, and so he says, "All right, you know, inbound it this way or whatever." You know, and you know, we're all supposed to laud the kid, and I ask my students about it, and some of them are like, They don't like that. They don't think he should do that. I'm more on the side of the commercial. I think that he did the right thing there and the laudable thing. But in a lot of situations, the thing that, you know, so Tom Brady, okay, so he probably could tell that it was underinflated, and probably the refs could too, as presumably they maybe don't have as much experience touching the footballs as Tom Brady does as a quarterback, but they touch it every down. Well, I think part of the question is, well, there's a difference between seeing that it's underinflated and knowing that it's underinflated to the point that it's beyond regulation.
Right.
And that you need a gauge for, I think, you know, as far as I can tell in some of the reports, they've mentioned how or some TV shows and ESPN has done this, where they have different levels of inflation in the balls and ask people to try to see, can you tell the difference between these footballs and tell me which one is the underinflated, which one isn't. And apparently people couldn't do it. Even football players, former football players couldn't get it right. And so that's interesting, although I'm with you. I think that the level of expertise that someone like Tom Brady, their officials have, would seem to suggest that they could tell the difference between these. But whether you could tell the difference, okay, well, this is clearly within regulation and not, that I'm much more willing to give you know, Brady the benefit of the doubt there, that,
right,
yeah, this is underinflated, this is the way I like it, and just kind of going with it and not thinking,
right,
that, well, maybe it's underinflated, thinking again, well, that is kind of the official's job, and the officials are touching it, and they don't seem to have a problem with it, so I don't have a problem with it. It's not my job to get the gauge out, and it's not even that it's not my job. It's not my responsibility. In some ways, it's sort of even prohibited from him to do that, right?
Right.
Now, could he ask the refs to check? Maybe, but that seems supererogatory. It seems going up above and beyond the call, yeah, of duty for a player to get to that level of interference into the officiating, and allow the officials to do it. Or maybe he says something to the ball boy or something like that, like,
right,
you know, but, and who knows, maybe they did. I don't think so, but,
yeah,
you know, it's a bizarre case for sure. And I think it is something that's overblown. And then of course there's a quick joke, or underblown, right? Cause it's
right,
underinflated. go ahead.
I do give I give Brady the benefit of the doubt here too. And the, you know, the question you pose to your students or this commercial, you know, the way I always think about this is, you know, if you and I are playing one-on-one basketball and, you know, you're dribbling or the ball goes out of bounds, but off my fingertip, it seems like I'm, you know, like beholden to you to say, you know, oh, hey, Sean, you know, I got a piece of that. It's actually your ball. Yeah. And it seems counterintuitive or just blatantly wrong that if we say, hey, let's get it an unbiased outside observer to come in and make these judgments for us, that all of a sudden that situation should become less fair, right? That by adding a referee, all of a sudden I put my hands up like I didn't touch it and I get the ball. Like, the addition of the referee should make the game more fair, not less. And so I actually do this with my goalies now. Like, I used to, back when I played, the ball would go off my fingertip and I would call for the ball as though I needed the ball because we were going to transition to offense. I now have my goalies just do a quick, like, kind of snap their fingers, not to put it in the ref's face, like, oh, you missed the call, but just, I got a piece of that. And literally one time just this season, the referee, I was like, yeah, he got that. And the referee said, but then it's going to be the other team's ball. And I said, yeah, I know.
I know that's, it is the other team's ball.
And the other, the other coach was screaming, he blocked it. Look, even their coach is saying it. And like, yeah, so let's just give him the ball. And he's like, no, it's your ball. And I'm like, okay. I mean, at that point, okay, here we go. So yeah. I think that can kind of be, the logic of that is a little bit questionable. But again, coming back to Deflategate, I'm with you. I don't think we have to have Brady running around trying to police, you know, the official nature of everything.
Yeah, no, that's true. So I guess I'm curious what if we find out that the Patriots intentionally altered these balls, what do you think the appropriate punishment ought to be? I mean, do you think it should be a fine, suspensions? What do you, have you thought about that at all?
You know, I haven't at all. So, it's a little bit out of my purview. I mean, boy, making the punishment fit the crime.
Yeah.
You know, it's a little bit like, you know, fining someone for parking in a legal spot. Like, wait, I park here and you take $100 of my dollars. Like, how is that a fitting punishment? What does taking dollars from me have to do with my parking on your property illegally? I've seen commentators suggest that they forfeit a draft pick. That seems strong, but maybe that sends the kind of message that, you know, it's one of those, like, why are we punishing? Is it retributive in nature or utilitarian? Like, look, if you guys are going to try to tweak the game illegally, we're going to come down hard on you. And I guess if there really is, I mean, if we have evidence, you know, emails sent or the ball boy comes forward and says, I can't take it anymore, Belichick made me do it. I would want the punishment to be harsher rather than lenient. This feels out of my purview to say what that would mean. I think certainly fines seem so silly in this sport, you know, like, it's hard for me to imagine making that much money and having to give up. You know, Belichick was trying to find whatever, $500,000 for, I can't believe I'm going to say this, film gate.
Right.
I don't know. What's $500,000 to a guy who makes that much? Does that really do anything? Seems like a lot to me. But once you start taking away draft picks, then I think you're getting them where it hurts.
Yeah. No, it's a tricky question. And it's one that's been posed to me a couple times now. And I'm not really sure the answer. I think suspensions of the players, I think goes too far, just given the severity of it, because it doesn't seem like this is really, like, you know, it's not a major rule, it's not a major violation. It seems, I mean, use the example of a parking fine, it seems more in that order of things, of speeding or some kind of traffic violation, rather than, you know, some kind of major felonious assault or something like that. And so, you know, it does seem that you want to try to fit the punishment to the crime in some way. And you know, it this doesn't seem to be too major of a thing, and so I think some kinds of fines, maybe draft picks, which that does seem kind of harsh, but you know, maybe it does send the signal, like you said. But suspensions and taking, you know, getting, changing the outcome of games because of suspensions, that seems to be too harsh, yeah. considering that for the most part, as far as we can tell, this activity didn't change the outcome of any other games itself, right? They apparently, you play the second half with regulation balls. That's what's being reported now. And the Patriots had a better offense in the second half. So it's hard to say that the inflated or deflated balls really seem to have much of an impact. Again, that doesn't mitigate, that doesn't excuse violating the rule. And if they did violate the rules, they should be punished. But it's an interesting question of just how far. And from a sports ethics or just philosophic perspective, it does kind of get at that interesting question of why do we punish? What's an effective punishment? What's the point of all that? And how to bring all that into the conversation, but it.
Well, I don't. I may, and this is a matter of degree, but I may think it a bigger infraction than you're leading on, in the sense that, it's not major. Like if I lure you out of your home and then figure out a way to break into your home to steal a $5 bill from you, like I stole $5. Like okay, wrong. I shouldn't do that. But whoa, wait a minute. You lured him out of his house and you picked his locks and you went through his stuff and you stole $5. Like. If you're willing to go into the game and affect the actual object, the primary object that is used in that game, to intentionally alter it to suit your team, like that seems to me like a major offense. Like, whoa, if you're willing to do that, like what else are you willing to do? So again, on the one side of things, you did the equivalent of parking illegally or stealing $5. But it seems like in principle, maybe a bigger issue.
Yeah, I know. I mean, you're monkeying with the integrity of the game, and that does need to be taken into account here. And so part of it is also, what do we actually find out, right? I mean, how were they just trying to skirt the line, like keeping it right at 12 and a half, right at the low end of the regulation, because that's what they want. And so they ended up getting lower because of miscalibration or because of the weather and the changes and the effects and so on, or the differences between where it's inflated and the temperature in those rooms and then where it's checked and then when it's outside for 2.5, right? All those different things that could affect the PSI, and I'm not a physicist, but apparently could affect it in a way that it did unintentionally, particularly if they keep it at the low end, versus really going out of their way to make sure that it is under, knowing that they're playing with balls that are under, rather than risking playing, knowing that, and this is now, again, this is where maybe my Patriots fandom might skew me a little bit, but I tend to think that what's probably most likely the case here is that they were probably just skating the line and trying to get as close as they could to having an underinflated ball that was still regulation, but that because of various other kinds of conditions, they ended up going under regulation, but that they weren't shooting to be under regulation. They were shooting to be right on the line.
Right.
And one of my concerns with that is if you're doing that, you need to be cognizant of the fact that you are doing that and that there is that chance. And so you try to mitigate against that. And so, okay, well, there are weather conditions here that might affect this. Let's see how that might affect it. Now, the other wrinkle here is I think the kind of wink wink aspect of the officials in the league and the teams of not really checking this and not really paying much attention to it, and so teams kind of getting complacent and thinking that, well, there isn't anything that they really need to pay attention to here, and that they can just go ahead and do what they want as long as it's not too far to the extreme, and here someone blew a whistle and so now the NFL has to come down hard when they've tacitly, or at least I'm suggesting, maybe tacitly over the years have allowed this to go on. And that does change the evaluation as well of it doesn't, again, if you violate a rule and it's been allowed to violate, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're in the clear. But you know, when, if to go back to the traffic violations, right? I mean, if the cops always allow you to go 75 in this 65 zone, and then all of a sudden, decide not to do it, that seems unfair. All of a sudden, well, you've been letting me do this, and I passed you before many times. What's the deal? But, you know, at the same time, yeah, look, that we're now enforcing it. Okay.
Right.
And you're the first one that we're enforcing it on. And so you feel screwed, but you know, people down the line won't be, because that's the rule. And maybe it's unfortunate the Patriots have to be in that situation and be the ones that kind of set the standard, so to speak. But it'd be curious. I mean, I don't know if we'll ever find out really what's going on. It seems like a hard, unless, like you said, the rogue ball boy comes forward or something like that. I'm not sure we'll ever really know unless there's some kind of revelation of that sort, which I don't think we'll end up getting. And so I'm curious to see how the NFL is going to go forward.
It's the intent that matters here.
Yeah.
That we never get at the crux of the actual intent, but that's what's important. And again, I'm agreeing with you. I think the intent was not nefarious.
And that's what groups these three together is, because it's about the intent and about, like, sort of how far, how close to the line can you get to, and as if trying to ride that line, is that itself even wrong, right? That knowing that you're going up against that, and I don't think that that's wrong, and I think that that's where a lot of innovation and greatness can come in sport and in life, by going up against that line and pushing against it, but then also being wary of what happens if you go a little bit too far. And so but I do think that's where civilization often advances, is when people are willing to push against those lines.
Yeah.
Any last words?
No, I love that. I actually had literally at the top of my notes when I was thinking about this yesterday, I wrote pushing the rules equals profound opportunity for reflection. And I love that's where you ended up finishing off. And I think that's one of the great things about sport ethics and looking at these gray areas, is it really like gives us a chance to reflect. And then, as you also mentioned, to reflect on things, you know, outside of our sports and in daily life. So it's for me, it was a great tie-in there to these issues.
All right. Thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Sean.
This has been the Sports Ethics Podcast. You can find us at sportsethicist.com, Facebook, and Twitter, and you can email the show at sportsethicist@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks for listening.